Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and I'm sitting here with Robert Sachs, who is a practitioner of Ayurveda, but he's also integrated Tibetan medicine. He's a social worker. He's the author of how many books?
Seven books,
including The Passionate Buddha, Rebirth into the Pure Land, which I think we'll talk about a bit. The Ecology of Oneness. That is your latest book.
That's the latest one.
And this is about what exactly?
Basically how we live in a cooperative universe, and as we include and become more inclusive in our perspective, things seem to work better.
Mm. And then Buddhist Masters, which is a great series of interviews with people like Robert Thurman, introduction forward by the Dalai Lama himself, and Becoming Buddha, which everybody wants to do.
It'd be useful.
Awakening the wisdom and compassion to change your world.
Yes.
But, you know, let's take a big look at this. I mean, you've been interested in the West, macrobiota, the Eastern philosophies. Are things changing now? Do you see a big change in Western consciousness, spirituality, health?
Well, I think what's interesting, Alan, is this. It's a conversation that is very pertinent to the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the reason why I wrote The Ecology of Oneness. And it was in the context of the interviews that I did with all the various Buddhist teachers, where we were looking at the next 50 to 100 years as to what's going on the planet.
Right.
And what I would say is that by and large, the Western teachers were kind of optimistic from the standpoint of, oh, we've got the internet, we've got all these, all sorts of things that are like in terms of knowledge and information, which are beginning to share in a much more broad way.
Yeah.
The fact that there is so much more transparency, which is not necessarily what, let's say, clandestine organizations or political institutions like,
right.
But there's a lot more transparency. So there's opportunities. And then, so they were very psyched or inspired by
the Western teachers. Yeah.
But the Tibetan teachers, like Khunzig Shama Rinpoche, Tarteng Tulku Rinpoche, Joan Halifax, Robert Thurman, getting back to the more oriental ones, they were a little bit more skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why they were more skeptical was they said, in the history of this planet, we've seen this before.
I don't know if that's true, though.
Let's put it this way. If you begin to look at the fact, for example, we in the West have the idea of the Buddha Sakyamuni,
right.
From 2,500 years ago.
Right.
If you understand that the Buddha Sakyamuni is the fourth historical Buddha.
Okay.
The third historical Buddha was a Buddha by the name of Kashyapa.
Oh.
Kashyapa lived 18,000 years ago.
I didn't know that.
In Afghanistan.
Oh. Okay.
Before that, about 45, 50,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
You had Kanaka Muni, who was the second historical Buddha.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then 100,000 years ago, you had Krakuchanda, who was the first historical Buddha.
Where's the history of this written?
If you look in the Buddhist Sutras, you will find the history behind all of these. And they lived in different parts of the Far East,
uh-huh.
from India, but also, like I said, in terms of Afghanistan and that part of the world.
But they must have had a huge influence because here we are 100,000 years later.
And here we are, and what we do is we go in, what I would say is the working with the nature of consciousness and the transformation mm-hmm. of the mind is an asymmetrical war. So there are certain aspects of our consciousness which becomes refined, and there's other parts which slip off the grid for a while and get out of control, and then we have to work on those. And so it is a progressive process, but at the same time, what I would say is, and this is what I look at, is that it's such a it's a wish, and it's a positive wish, and it's a good wish
mm-hmm.
to think that we are going in a really great direction with respect to the Aquarian vision of the world.
Yeah, an evolutionary direction. I mean, it seems like the internet is an evolutionary tool.
Yes.
For oneness, for the
absolutely.
Ecology of oneness.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and to some extent, I would say it's a manifestation of, at the same time, where you have the idea of the indigo children, or you have mm-hmm. people of consciousness who seem to be able to see between the veils of reality much more easily.
Yes.
So to me, it is a sort of like a technological manifestation of what's happening within the human psyche as well. Mm. So that is there. The issue that I have is, and this is where I look at, there was one teacher I interviewed for Wisdom of the Buddhist Masters, and he was an English Theravadan abbot. And he said that in the Theravadan tradition, there is a notion that we have entered a dark age, and the dark age began in 1956,
according to the Theravadan tradition. Really? I was born that year.
Yeah, okay, all right. And what's interesting about it is, that was about the time when President Dwight D. Eisenhower started speaking and warning people about a military-industrial complex.
That's true, okay. Yes.
And what they say about this Dark Age period, according to this one teacher, his name was Ajahn Amaro, or that's his name, is Ajahn Amaro. He said, the idea of a Dark Age is, in the first 100 years of a Dark Age, is like a brilliant golden age. It's like suddenly everything becomes more transparent. So suddenly you had the Beat Generation, you had the 60s emergence of consciousness, you have the appearance of Indian and Buddhist teachers all over the planet, you have the strong interaction between Eastern and Western cultures. And then what you see is, about 2006, you started having controversies. You started at political intrigues.
I guess.
Even within the Tibetan community and the various spiritual communities and the various kinds of crises, as well as the embarrassment issues that mm-hmm. came up in terms of sexuality and teachers mm-hmm. and all these kinds of things. So the idea was, about 50 years in, 2006, things began to kind of drop off, so that these things like the time of the guru and the time of all the proliferation of all these traditions has begun to wane more. Mm. You see, like, it's not as fascinating and as well presented as we were seeing before then. And so the idea is that we're still in a golden age. We are still where the opportunities, I mean, here we are, we're in this center in Weston, Connecticut, where this woman is created, Barbara Saint has created this amazing transformational like portal for people. And there are places that are like that mm-hmm. all over the planet.
Absolutely. More and more.
Yes. And the idea is that there is an opportunity for people to really transform themselves, and at the same time, to think that suddenly you're going to see the massive acceptance of organic food, or this.
But we are. So organic food is in supermarkets now.
It's in supermarkets, and at the same time, we're still dealing with the fact that the AMA and various sort of like more draconian organizations and institutions
right.
are pushing back very hard. There are physicians that are losing their licenses.
Right, and there's GMOs like that. And that yeah. don't want to be labeled and all that.
Exactly. So what I look at is this, is that we work on this global vision. We work on trying to expand light as best we can.
Uh-huh.
We work on ourselves and also try and make it so that we do not buy into or allow ourselves to succumb to the idea of any kind of Pollyannish vision of the future. Mm-hmm. I think that,
like, if, oh, it's all going to be great and all that.
It's all going to be great.
No, we have to work hard for it.
We have to work hard. And I think in many respects, it's like, I remember probably the best example of that was, I had an opportunity to meet Rolling Thunder.
Mm-hmm. He was an intense guy.
Yeah, Rolling Thunder. And he came to Lexington, Kentucky, mm-hmm. where we were living, and we had a chance to sit with him. And he talked about the idea of how a shaman goes through the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the shaman sometimes acts like the fool, mm-hmm. acts like they cloak their light. And what they do is They move through, they transform what they can, but they also know not to suddenly decide that they're going to get on NBC News and start talking about the Hopi vision necessarily.
Right, right.
Okay? So to me, it's like, okay, how do you learn to develop? And this is where I go in the ecology of oneness, is like with all this growth that is going on, how do you develop the mindfulness and the discernment mm-hmm. to know where to shine, when to step back? How do you learn to become more effective in making the light available to people mm-hmm. without creating a situation where we create more martyrs and more people being, you know, discredited or whatever? It's kind of like, you know,
well,
I mean...
And how do you answer that question? How do we?
What I think is you keep on developing your own mindfulness. You keep on developing your critical thinking skills, which to me means that part of this journey for every one of us is not only to be engaged in media, to be engaged in what is available to us in terms of the informational stuff, but there's got to be a way in which we work with the nature of our own minds to understand what in Buddhism is called emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very interesting quote that I identify with very strongly. It's a Zen master who said, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences.
Right, the third patriarch.
Yeah, third patriarch, okay. Exactly, of Zen. And so to me, he said, do not look for the truth, only cease to cherish opinion. Okay? So to me, what it is sadly, or it's just the way things are, that there is wisdom available all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people that, because of the refinement of their consciousness from previous existence or from their education, can turn to a wisdom tradition and suddenly find themselves inspired and move in that direction without a lot of hiccups in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
They just embrace it. They get it. Okay.
Right.
But for the most part, the best teacher on the planet is disaster.
It can be. I mean, yes, it has been. But there are people I meet all the time who are having spontaneous awakenings.
Exactly.
They read a book, they do a Kundalini meditation, boom.
Well, this is where what you have is, you know, when, you know, you meet the teacher when the mind is ready for
right.
the teacher to arise. That, obviously, it is happening more and more.
Yes, it seems like it. Yeah.
And at the same time, what I would say is that, and this is something where you get to the background of this, is also to realize that oftentimes those stories in people's lives do come from a death in a family.
Mm-hmm.
The experience of the appearance of an illness,
mm-hmm.
which suddenly makes them have to confront the fact that it no longer works. Or they go to work and they watch, you know, it's like I have a good friend who is now part of a sustainable community in the area where we live in the Central Coast of California, who basically stepped out of a job from Goldman Sachs,
mm-hmm.
decided she'd had enough. She stepped out of a six-figure salary.
Mm-hmm.
She had seen things were transparent. The veil had been lifted for her. And so she just stepped away. So that is occurring. But it occurs for a lot of people in the context of that.
No, disaster. It's true. That is one way. And I think because we are changing.
You're more optimistic than I am.
I'm very optimistic because
yeah.
I've seen awakening.
Sure.
And it has come from disaster, or it can come because I think, and I disagree with tradition in a sense, because I don't know if the past can actually predict the future. Yes, if there's a great oneness of consciousness, perhaps, but I also think the future is being created.
Yes.
And I think we're moving, this is just my opinion, into an unknown territory. And I think there's a vibration, not to be
yes.
too new age, but there's a vibration that's lifting us up to a place we haven't been before.
And what I would say in that way, Alan, is this.
Yes.
Does that, because thought precedes mm-hmm. manifestation.
Yes,
okay.
I agree. Yeah.
So then the question becomes this. It's kind of like the idea of how I describe it is, it's like jumping off a cliff and having an epiphany that it was the wrong decision. But meanwhile, gravity has its way with you. So maybe that lesson goes into the seed consciousness of your next life. Okay. So what I look at is this, is like, and for example, in Buddhist tradition, you have the tradition of the Kala Chakra Bodhisattva, or the Kala Chakra Buddha, who looked at the idea that in terms of the realm of Shambhala and in terms of the evolutionary process that we're going through, that this dark age would continue until a point at which people look around and go, you know, this doesn't work.
Well, and they're saying that now.
And there's a sufficient number of people that are in all sorts of strata of society. Now, the thing is this. The question becomes, do we, in our lifetime, have to see that? Or do we, in our lifetime, have to keep on projecting our light towards that vision? Because to me, that's what becomes important. Mm-hmm. If we get too excited, or if we get too hooked on the idea of what the vision
could be, ahead of ourselves. Yes.
What ends up happening is we start short-circuiting that process. Now, the thing is this, and this is where you start getting into the, this is sometimes, I remember at one point, this was described to me by a high Tibetan Lama. And it was like the idea that clans and families and societies have their own karma. And sometimes what happens is that in the context of those structures, things move very, very slowly. And what you do is, let's say you know what you'd like to see, but what you can do incrementally is just change one little bit of it. What you do is you lessen the karmic load. You lessen the way in which suffering is being created by this or that society, so that there are these positive movements that you see. But then we go, well, why can't we go for broke? Why can't we just make it all that way based on the vision? The answer is because the collective way in which those karmic patternings are makes that difficult to occur. But that doesn't mean that you don't keep going. There's a whole story in terms of the idea of what, there's a wonderful book. It's called The Wheel of Sharp Weapons.
Okay, is it Tibetan?
It's a Tibetan book. There's a book about it called The Bodhisattva Way of Life, which is the Bodhisattva Charivatara. That's the Sanskrit name for it. The Wheel of Sharp Weapons, I don't know the Tibetan or the Sanskrit name for it, but it was written as a compendium to the Bodhisattva Way of Life. And in the beginning, it talks about the idea of what a bodhisattva is. What is a sort of like a messianic, positive, forward-thinking human, okay, that thinks more of the world around them than just themselves.
Right.
And the idea is that that a bodhisattva is someone that can walk in the world and not be negatively influenced by it. He says they're like a peacock. Peacocks wander through the jungles and eat poisonous plants and they don't get bothered by them. In the same way, bodhisattvas are like peacocks walking down the streets of New York.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
So the idea is that you go into that situation and you just keep on lightening the load. You keep your mind focused on what you want. You keep on trying to extend light without succumbing to aggravation, without succumbing to frustration, without succumbing to depression. That's why I wrote the book, Becoming Buddha. It's like, these are the small lessons we need. We need to have these things, because as we step into these things, we need to be aware of it, you know? And in that way, it's like, what, or how does a bodhisattva, or how does an awakened being act? If you're in a relatively comfortable environment and you work with the transformation of thought patterns for people, that's what you do. But I'm reminded of when Mother Teresa said to a starving man, God comes in the form of bread. If he has one moment where he's somewhat satisfied, he's no longer thinking in a desperate way. In that moment where you suspend his desperation, there's a possibility that a positive thought emerges. So for him, getting him fed may be the first step, rather than saying, you know, your suffering is a result of your karma. It's like, you know.
Right. That's the negative side of karma, of this understanding.
Exactly.
So you're saying it's not possible to wipe out karma and the history of lineages and the thought forms that have oppressed humanity. We have to do it slowly. Or it's being done slowly. Not that it has to be, but that's... it's a slow process, the evolution of humanity. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, at the same time, what we're looking at is, and this was very fascinating. It's one of the things I mentioned in Ecology of Oneness. I met a really wonderful teacher by the name of Namgyal Rinpoche. Okay, so Tibetan Buddhist teacher, but his story is that he was a Presbyterian minister.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
He was a Presbyterian minister, mm-hmm. and what happened was that he had studied comparative religion, and one day he woke up and realized he understood Sanskrit fluently.
Really? Without even studying it?
No.
Okay.
So he had a bit of a flip out, and he decided he needed to go to India. Mm-hmm. So he went to India, and he went to Sikkim. And he went to a teacher, this was the 16th Gyalwa Karmapa, who I had a great fortune of meeting when I was in my 30s, 20s and 30s. And he came to this monastery in Sikkim and walks in. Mm-hmm. And the Karmapa looks at him and goes, oh, you're back. Mm-hmm. He goes, what do you mean I'm back? He goes, well, this is who you were in your past lives. Mm-hmm. Now you're back. Brilliant teacher. He used to take people on cruises, on luxury cruises, and teach them Dharma, teach them meditation.
Did he remember being back once the teacher reminded him?
Yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh. So what he was talking about was the idea of an Aquarian age,
and he said, which is what I'm all about in a way.
Yeah, and he said the Aquarian age has two sides to it. Mm-hmm. The Aquarian age, one vision is where there's massive transformation. Mm-hmm. And he said thus that between the various ages, like you're going from the what are called the golden ages, the silver ages, and the bronze ages, which we're now in a bronze age according to Ayurvedic or Indian astrology, Jyotish.
Yeah, some people say that.
We're in a bronze age, okay?
Is that the Kali Yuga? No.
Kali Yuga is a dark age, but it is we're still in a bronze age. And the idea is that what he was saying in terms of our Western idea of Aquarius, mm-hmm. was that the Aquarian age could be massive transformation, or it could be a time where there would be increased bureaucratization, which is what we're seeing in draconian ways of dealing with things. And at the same time, there would be pockets of light, mm-hmm. which is what I describe in the Ecology of Oneness. And that's what I look at is this, for example, where we are, mm-hmm. Life Balance Center in Western Connecticut, is a pocket of light.
Right.
It is a pocket of light. And what it is you keep those beacons alive on the hillsides, mm-hmm. because as people realize that the habitual, the preferred cultural paradigm is no longer working for them, mm-hmm. they need to know. They'll say, well, what's next? What's possible? And suddenly they will see these lights in the hills. They'll see these lights down the road. Mm-hmm. And what will happen is they will come. And I mean, my wife Melanie and I see this all the time. We've had it where when we were running meditation centers, and we'd have high teachers there, and we'd have homeless people arrive and go, we just saw the light.
That's funny.
You know, and they just show up at the door, mm-hmm. you know? And so to me, it's like there needs to be that. So it's like, I'm not saying, would I like to see Whole Foods be the mega company of the way in which food is produced in the world? I absolutely can hold a vision of that being possible.
Well, okay? it is changing. I mean, 20 years changing. Ago, no one heard of it.
Oh, no, no, not at all. I mean, yeah. You know, we now can eat coconut ice cream. What's that about, okay? All right? You know, my kids had to suffer with brown rice.
Right. Okay. But so there's a change you acknowledge, of course.
Oh, totally.
And you're saying there's more possibilities of containment.
What my personal way of approaching this is that I want it, the more that you work with the nature of your own mind, mm-hmm. the more you continue to deepen your meditative understanding, the more you begin to understand that nature of emptiness, which interesting, the nature of emptiness, a good friend of mine, Lama Ola Nudel, once said, you have a grasp of emptiness when you can think of others more than yourself.
That makes sense.
Okay. That what happens is that as that develops more, suddenly you have fewer enemies in the world. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you begin to be able to be the friend to someone who you thought was adversarial to your situation, because suddenly you're developing an openness in your state of consciousness that allows for there to be an interaction. Mm-hmm. And therefore, in the tolerance and the compassion that is developed, you begin to see these transformational states. So to me, it's like what you're saying. I don't want people to rush ahead. It's like, okay, these things are here. This means things are changing. The answer is, yes, they are. And still chop wood, carry water.
Right.
Still do your homework. If you jump ahead and say, now I've been to a workshop over the weekend, and now I know everything's good.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like what happened when, and I hate to use a political example.
That's okay.
But a political example was that I was flying into London when Barack Obama was elected president of the United States. Mm-hmm. So 2008. And then a few days later, I saw him come out of the White House for the first time. He came into the White House, and the BBC was showing him come out of the White House, and he looked totally ashen. He looked like he had just the veil.
It's a lot of karma to take on.
The veil had been lifted as to what he was going to be dealing with. And what I said at that time, I wrote a little note that is in Becoming Buddha, and it was a letter to Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And I said, we are really happy that you're here, but we are going to hold your feet to the fire the whole time. Mm-hmm. Because we realize what is you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And unless we keep vigilant to this process, nothing's going to get done. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that what happened was that the progressive movement in the United States went to sleep.
Because Barack Obama was...
Yeah, and he got the Nobel Peace Prize and wasn't going to be great.
Which was ridiculous, of course.
Of course, it was ridiculous. But at the same time, people can have that state of mind where they think then with that, when that happens, this means everything's going to be great.
Right.
And what it means is, no, we still have to chop wood. We still have to carry water. So for me, that's what I want to see people do. I want people to hold on to that vision. I want them to feel the possibility of that light. Mm. But it's almost like I want people to be streetwise about it. You have to have your street smarts in this situation.
Yeah. I mean, what you're talking about can be compared to systems, complexity theories, you know, when...
Sure.
When a system is at a certain level and more elements come added into it, it has to go to a higher level of complexity, but it has to collapse. It has to restructure itself. So either it restructures itself and it doesn't succeed because it doesn't have enough elements in place, or it does restructure itself and a new level of operation can come into play. And you never know. Are there enough people pushing from underneath to create a higher level of awakening and consciousness?
Well, it's kind of like the idea of the 100th monkey principle.
I guess.
You know, when does that happen and at what level? And to me, that does occur. So when you're talking about greater levels and this whole vision of light expanding, the question then becomes, okay, does that manifest itself initially with all the monkeys living in accordance with it, or do they first get the inkling of something which they then act upon? So to me, what it is I do believe that what's going on is, and it is funny to watch mm-hmm. when you see, my own teacher kind of pushed me back.
Who was that?
Khunzig Shama Rinpoche. Mm-hmm. He pushed me out into the everyday contemporary world. I'm sort of working outside of the context of the Buddhist communities right now, based on his blessing and encouragement. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there I am in a relatively conservative environment, and I will suddenly hear a way of thinking like, wow, I would have never thought that statement or that idea would have come out of your mouth.
Out of your mouth.
Out of your mouth.
Like what? Like,
well, I mean, it's kind of like, I remember at one point, I'm driving down the road and I'm listening to a Motel 6 commercial. Mm-hmm. And in the Motel 6 commercial, it says, it's like Nirvana. And you're going, are you serious? That really just came out of a Motel 6 commercial.
That's right, isn't it?
You know, or when you hear, and even when it's done in a facetious way where you'll have a commercial where suddenly we'll start chanting Om. Probably the best example of this, and this was, there's two different ways I've seen this. One was Eddie Murphy was in a movie. I don't know if you remember it. The movie was called Golden Child.
I didn't see it, but I did.
Okay. It was one of those movies which many people thought, oh, this is a bogus film. And Eddie Murphy, it was one of those movies I think he would have wanted to forget, mm-hmm. was part of his repertoire. But it was an extremely powerful film. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of amazing messages in it. Mm-hmm. And this was actually in keeping with the idea that in the early 1980s, one of the Tibetan teachers said that he really wanted to see Buddhism or Dharmic ideas have an impact on the black community, mm-hmm. which is more and more present. You see the principles of mindfulness within, you know, you think of Van Jones you're seeing the various communities pick up. And to me, that particular movie was it hokey? Was it kind of like spiritual and weird and like that? But it was conveying various aspects of consciousness.
It plants a seed.
It plants a seed.
Yeah.
So to me, when I see media, when I see the idea of a pizza shop in a local town suddenly having a gluten-free option or something like that.
Why?
Okay? Mm-hmm. Something is changing where the idea of we're not just doing business as usual. Sure, we're trying to take advantage of a new mm-hmm. part of the market, but that means there's a certain level of consciousness about something
right.
which is beginning to speak.
Right. This is the spiritualization of America, of the modern world. It is happening. It is undeniable.
It is happening. And even if we go, I look at the current where we are right now, 8 days before the election and whatever is going to happen. Mm-hmm. To me, I look at this and go, this is not changing. It's going to keep on accelerating. And what we need to do is keep on focusing. It's like there's a saying in Buddhism where you don't take refuge in samsara. What samsara is mm-hmm. is conditioned existence. It is what we see in the world around us, the external facade mm-hmm. of what we see. And what we do is that facade is really just a projection of our own consciousness. Mm-hmm. Okay, what they say in
tradition. That's your drama, your story.
Exactly, and the idea is that a dark age mm-hmm. or a Kali Yuga is not about a time period. It is about the clouds in consciousness.
It's a state of mind.
It's a state of mind. And therefore what happens is that in that we all have our avarice, we have our own greed, we all have our own jealousies, we all have our preferences. We all have our, in terms of mm-hmm. do not look for, there's only cease to cherish opinions. We all have our own opinions about mm-hmm. things. And what we do is, even if they are enlightened, quote unquote, enlightened opinions, they're still opinions.
Well, would you say it's a sort of collective hero's journey? You know, the hero's journey.
Oh, absolutely.
Where we're going in, we got pulled into the dark and the underworld, but we're in, and now we have a choice to come out and give a hope and upliftment and a boon.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's what I see.
Yeah, and what I would say is
only because I want to say, when I hear like there's no hope in the dark, and it seems like we are stuck forever in this doomed outcast world, and I always think there is hope of salvation, revelation, whatever, awakening, whatever you want to call that, and I think that's the natural process of consciousness itself.
Yeah, I think what it is is that this is what makes it important for people that have the luxury of time, opportunity, finances, circumstances to keep on working to be able to help others.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Absolutely.
Because what happens is, and this is it's very interesting. When I interviewed Robert Thurman and we were talking about some of the signposts of a dark age or a dark time, was that life expectancy was going to get shorter and shorter and shorter, and that there would be more degenerative diseases that impacted people at earlier and earlier ages. Okay. We see a tremendous advance in terms of longevity and everything like that, but there are places on this planet where, and he gave an example, okay, because I personally view Robert Thurman as very positive, but what he said was, there are parts of this world where young kids have been born from parents that have AIDS, who are carrying AIDS. By the time they're 9, they become sex workers, and they die by the time they're 11 years old.
I'm sure.
So there are parts of the world that are like that. He said, so in terms of a dark age, they are already there.
Yeah.
They are already there. And what we need to realize is our job is to lessen the likelihood that that occurs.
Yes, I agree.
We were talking earlier off camera a while back where you were talking to me about Deva Premal, who's a dear friend.
Yes.
And I hosted a concert with her on the Central Coast of California, and it was her first live stream concert worldwide. Mm-hmm. It was on International Day of Peace in 2007. And there we were in this, you know, at this, you know, auditorium. And I said, you know, folks, here we are. And whether you accept it or not, we're probably in one of the most peaceful countries in the world.
Mm-hmm. I think we are.
All right. And we live in the most peaceful state in the most country in the world. And in this most peaceful state, we live in the most pristine, peaceful part of this pristine, beautiful, peaceful state.
Was that Northern California?
No, Central Coast of California.
Okay, yeah, Central Coast.
It's kind of like, I remember Ram Dass once was visiting. At one point, he turned around and he goes, where have you guys been hiding? I mean, why does this place even exist?
Yeah.
So to me, I look at it as being like the Athens of the West Coast, actually.
So what about that,
What happened was this. And I said, listen, folks, the result is that we have surplus. We have surplus of time. We have surplus of energy. We have a kind of positivity that we can evoke because our food, the air is chronically rich. We have opportunity.
Absolutely.
We cannot sit back like cats with a bowl full of cream and just say, I've got mine, the hell with everybody else.
Right.
We need to devote ourselves to radiating out. Mm-hmm. That's what we need to do. And to me, that's...
You said this to the audience.
Oh, I said this to the audience, and it went live stream worldwide.
Beautiful.
And so, to me, that's what happens. You come to a place like this, maybe you have your own individual suffering that has brought you to the light, and you can only deal with your own consciousness, and you're finally getting rid of your own negative patterns, which is really, really great, because no longer are you harming yourself. You stop inflicting pain on others that have to witness you in pain, which is wonderful. Then what happens is then there's another level that perhaps you can go to. Perhaps in your entire life, the best thing you can do is just keep a peaceful life for yourself. And that's wonderful. That's really wonderful. But if you begin to have a little bit more surplus, mm-hmm. a little bit more time, and you can step out of your door and work on a soup line or donate to somebody or help somebody out. Eventually, you begin to understand that in that state of mind, surplus builds more surplus.
Is this the ecology of oneness?
This is the ecology of oneness. Uh-huh. This is the essence of this. That the more we do it, the more it occurs.
Is it happening? Is it working? Are people sending out the surplus of energy to the...
I think so. I really do. The thing is, we live in a very, very, I believe, a very cooperative universe. I believe that there are, I mean, what I say to people is, you know, I don't care what you believe. You know, you can engage God, if you believe in a single God, you can engage in a single God. If you believe in a pantheon of God, find out what these gods do, because gods rule the seas, gods rule the lands, mm-hmm. or sorts of things. If you believe in pixies, if you believe in fairies, they have their roles. If you believe in trolls have their roles.
Right.
Everything like that. The idea to me is this. So as you begin to work with your own consciousness, overcome those dark spaces in yourself, you then learn how to engage what was frightening for you. You learn to engage what was the more challenging edges to your life. You begin to be able to be more receptive to people that were harder to deal with and encourage them in the same way.
Did this understanding come about because, what's that book? You've had a difficult time here when you... did it come through your own suffering in a sense? Because maybe it didn't. I don't know, but I know you've had...
I don't know. You're showing the book Rebirth into Pure Land,
yeah.
Okay, and which is the story of the death and transformation of our daughter through the practice of transference of consciousness.
You're very hopeful in a sense. Yes, you could look at something like that two ways, of course. You could be depressed your whole life, or you can say there's a bigger picture.
Oh, I mean, you know, and what I would say, the interesting thing about the story of my daughter, mm-hmm. which is explained there, but the encapsulation of the outer manifestation of that is the Buddhist Lama who did this transference of consciousness practice for her.
Mm.
When people heard what happened...
What can you explain transference of consciousness for her?
All right, so we're on a whole track, but this is a...
I didn't mean to get off the track, but I just think
Where my life... Where my life... Have I always been positive? I would say the answer is... I think I've always been relatively positive.
It seems like it.
I think so. But it doesn't mean that, but it's been kind of unusual. I mean, I do a lot of work with the dying.
Uh-huh.
And my history with the dying goes early into my life, we lived next to a cemetery.
Wow, growing up?
Next to a cemetery. And I used to play on the graves.
You did?
And when the grave diggers came...
Where was this?
This was in Brecksville, Ohio.
Okay.
And... when the grave divers came to prepare another site for a grave, I'd ask them to throw me into the grave.
You would?
I would. I'd jump in.
That's a spiritual practice.
I would lie on the ground and just smell the earth. I thought, wow, this is so beautiful. And then they'd say, okay, it's time to get out. So they'd get me out of there. But anyway, what happened was, and my father was a veterinarian.
Mm.
And my father, at that time, there were no such things as pet cemeteries or whatever. I mean, there was nothing like that. What would happen is somebody had their dog hit by a car. And what would happen is they'd say, you know, Doc, can you take care of the dog? My father would wrap the dog in newspaper, put it in a cardboard box, and we would go to the Purina fertilizer factory.
Mm-hmm.
And my father called it the clink. Mm-hmm. And I can smell, it was like what in India must be described as the charnel grounds.
Mm,
it smelled of burning flesh. And I would smell it. And I know that smell. I mean, I can smell it to this day. And I would watch my father drop this box onto the conveyor belt that was then going to go down into the flames, which was then going to incinerate the animal and turn it into somebody's rose garden, whatever. Wow. Okay. And I watched this lots when I was little. Okay. So I was familiar with that. But fast forward into my life where the death of this one daughter was our third daughter. And it happened during a time when a Buddhist Lama, this Danish Buddhist Lama, was visiting us. And what happened was that when we found her, she died of sudden infant death.
Oh, when she was like 3 years old?
Sudden infant death, it doesn't happen after 2 years of age.
So she was under 2 years.
She was under 2 years. She was 48 days old.
Oh.
48 days old.
Oh, okay.
And so what happened was that we found her in the morning. She had died. As parents, you're looking forward for your first night's sleep. We had our first night's sleep and we woke up to a dead daughter.
Wow.
And so what happened was I held her corpse and I handed it to my friend, Lama Ola, and I said, do something. And so at that point when we found her, her fluids had stopped running, her face had become blue, and he did this practice called POA, transference of consciousness, which is a yoga. It's a yoga you can learn for yourself. It's a yoga that you can learn to do for someone else. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was that he did this, and after a half an hour, the fluids in her nose were running normally. Her face was a normal shape.
Did she come back into the body? No,
she didn't come back. She died. She was dead.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was her entire form changed. And once circulation stops, you can't make the body get warmed up again. Once fluids stop, the fluids don't start running again. These are signs that this POA works.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other signs that occur when you do it for yourself or you do it for another person is that there are broken blood vessels that occur on the top of the head, or even a spot of blood that occurs at the crown chakra.
What exactly is that they're doing?
What it is they are doing, or what I would do for myself or what I would do for someone else, is a visualization. You are visualizing the light body. You are visualizing the chakras, and you are imagining that you are seeing consciousness move up through the chakras to the highest point, which is the crown chakra, and then through sound and vision, you are projecting. And you have to remember that sound is faster than light.
Mm-hmm.
Sound is vibration, that if you speak over water, the molecules of water change. In the same way, when I speak to you or I speak to whoever, and suddenly there's a resonance in your heart of what I'm saying, that you know that somehow some energetic thing neurologically is happening in the other person. Is that imagined? The answer is no, it's not imagined, because in reality, everything is space.
So are there particular sounds that are done in this practice?
Certain sounds that are done, and those sounds are learned in the process of being initiated in the practice of POA.
And what's the overall purpose, like for your daughter or for someone else?
The purpose is to help the person to leave the body in the most auspicious manner possible. Insofar as you are a body of space and light first. There is a gradation of more positive and more confused emotions that make up who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is, how can you learn for yourself, or how can you help a loved one project themselves or leave their bodies
mm-hmm.
in a way that creates the most auspicious positive vibration that they have?
That purity of consciousness.
That purity of consciousness. And so that's what you focus on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an absolutely beautiful practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful practice to do for oneself, I mean, and you learn it in retreat situation. But, I mean, what's nice is, I mean, the one person that did make it very available to people as a sort of like an exercise is Sogyal Rinpoche, who wrote the book, The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying.
Yes.
In that, there's what's called a POA exercise. It's not the POA practice itself, but in my book, Rebirth into Pure Land, I give that practice. But it's one of those things you can learn to do. So what you do is you imagine, if you are Christian, you can imagine that what's happening is that you're seeing your loved one, their consciousness, move into the heart of Christ,
mm-hmm.
or to the heart of God, You want to see who is your source of inspiration, and that's where you wanted that person to go.
You know, I mean, the reason I brought that up is because that individual darkness, death, can we expand that to the oneness of the human race and see how we can take the rebirth into the pure land as a collective humanity and see if we can travel to a place where we are unified in consciousness, because we're really all one mind. Does that make sense? So yeah. How do we take like the individual practices of going into that, in a way, dark time, that death, and out the top and rebirthing humanity to be in the pure land, so we can live in a culture of pure landedness?
I think there's two different aspects of it. One aspect of it is to study and understand that's really true.
That we can. That it's possible. That's
not, no, it's not. It's not that we can. It already is. Mm. It already is. We are already there. We are never separate. We are really never alone. Okay? We're not separate from God in this moment, no matter how.
We're never not in the pure land.
We're never not there.
Right. Okay.
We just have to wake up. Which is what it's about. We have to wake up. Mm-hmm. So the idea is the pure lands are here. The emptiness nature of your mind, the purity of your mind, the fractal of God that you are, is always. The issue then becomes, what do you do to connect that? And therefore you have, in all wisdom traditions, you have your practices and you have your contemplations. Mm-hmm. Okay? Your contemplation is to begin to deconstruct reality to understand the nature of that metaphysical truth. Mm-hmm. That's the metaphysical truth. That's what's going on. That's where we already are. Okay? As long as we don't believe we're there, as long as we are clouded by our ignorance, our attachments, our aggression, our jealousy, our confusion, then what ends up happening is we keep on thinking that we're separate. Mm. Okay? So, we need to first grasp that we're there. We need to metaphysically understand that. But then, we need to do the homework to make it possible for us to transform those negative emotional states.
And otherwise,
what we do is we end up creating these pecking orders and in crowds of people who think they know what it is.
Right.
And then you need dispensation.
Well, some people say religion is that pecking order. I mean, it can be.
Of course. What it is it's like, you know, can you do this for me? And the answer is no. It's like this. There's a saying that a good teacher is someone who rows you to the other side and then burns your boat.
Exactly. So
you've got to be able to get back. You need to be able to go back and forth of your own accord. Mm-hmm. Now, some people need that help more, and that's fine. And some people learn that they, at some point in their journey, they get encouraged to do it on their own. Mm-hmm. My own teacher, for example, at some point, really pushed me out of the nest. Mm-hmm. It was like the baby bird. It was time to fly. And it was like, it was a joyful moment. It was really wild. I mean, everybody was freaking out what happened. It was like, wow, that felt so good. I felt so happy that he did it. Because a lot of what it was, Alan, was this, is that it is very, and I think this is, I mean, it's interesting. We've talked about our backgrounds in terms of all the different aspects mm-hmm. of the influences in our lives. Mm-hmm. And I think, although I would say I do, in terms of my more intercourse spiritual, Tibetan Buddhist spiritual practice, mm-hmm. I am still born Jewish. Mm-hmm. I'm still born American. Mm-hmm. I have American experiences.
Can't get away from that.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, in the Ecology of Oneness, I give my own story. I was conceived in sacred Native American land. Mm. I am a part of that Chippewa Valley. I am part of that. My food that I ate was from the blood that was spilled in that land. Mm. I have consumed that molecularly.
The Taoists say it's where you conceive that is more important than when you're born.
Yeah.
When and where.
My family has strong Mongolian ties. Mm-hmm. So I have Mongolian blood. So I can say I have a good genetic reason for being interested in Buddhism. Mm. Okay? All right? So there's that influence. There is my whole upper middle class Jewish upbringing. There is my movement into Buddhism. I am a Freemason. Freaks people out that I'm a Freemason, but there you go. I'm a Freemason Jewish Buddhist. Okay?
Okay.
Try and work that one out, okay? But there's all these different dimensions. And to me, what I say to people is this. If you say, well, I'm this, I've become a practitioner of the lineage of the Dalai Lama, I'm no longer part of that, then what ends up happening is you start creating an us versus them reality, mm-hmm. which will eventually create alienation in your consciousness, which will create levels of disappointment mm-hmm. when you get to that moment of death.
What we
have to do in this journey is to keep on breaking through those stories that say I'm this and not that. How do we begin to integrate what, you know, it's like, do I like Tsongpa? Do I like momos, Tibetan momos? Yeah, but I also like gefilte fish and I like matzo balls.
Right.
You know, nice. I can still that. I can still do that.
Yes.
So how do we begin to say, how do we become friends with all the things that maybe in the beginning, and this was a sad thing for me, like on this journey, is that when I began to study Buddhism, my family hired a deprogrammer because they thought I'd been brainwashed.
Right.
You know, yeah. And there was
what was that like, confronting that kind of...
It was very sad for a while because I didn't feel like I had changed.
No, did they get it, though? Did your family eventually get that?
Eventually.
It's not a program. It
took years.
It did.
It took years.
Wow.
You know.
That's a journey.
Oh, yeah. I even, to this day, I have a sister who really won't talk with me.
Well, because you're a Buddhist or whatever.
Yeah, and I've done all this weird and funky stuff.
But you weren't brought up Orthodox, were you?
No, not at all.
But you just wanted to see a different perspective, and that was...
Well, actually, I was going to become a rabbi.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, and then at one point I was sitting in a Rosh Hashanah service, and I looked around and I goes, this isn't me. This is not who I am. I don't know who I am at this point.
But this
isn't me. I'm not going to become a rabbi.
But you talked about doing the homework and the evolution and the freedom and the culture and the ecology of oneness. So what does that look like practically for us as a culture and individually? What is this?
I think it's very interesting, and I think some of it is dispelling the boundaries and the stories that we have. I mean, a good example of this is that, and this was, I would say, kind of like the physical expression of the ecology of oneness in terms of a book, is called a book by a guy by the name of Paul Hawken, who was the founder of Eden Foods.
Oh, yeah.
Blessed Unrest.
I have, yes, he's a great presenter.
Blessed Unrest.
Yes.
And Blessed Unrest, he was talking about the fact that there are over 100,000 NGOs all doing really good work. But everyone in those organizations has got their own little messianic story of the fact that their part of the story is going to save the planet.
Right.
So they don't communicate. They don't borrow from each other in terms of technology. Mm. They don't borrow each other in terms of marketing methodologies or the fact that, okay, this is part of what you do that would really fit in really well with what we're trying to accomplish.
Right.
So there's still part of this kind of dualistic perspective that comes from a mind not transformed.
Ego-based,
which is dualistic perspective,
right.
That keeps these organizations and groups separate.
Yeah.
And to me, what I say is, that's why spiritual practices is so important and why this disillusion of ego is so important. To me, as these NGOs begin to interact, as organizations begin to have a communication, a larger sense of speak, then this transformation.
Yeah, I think we're seeing that. I think Pope Francis is a revolution.
Great example of it.
Yes.
Fantastic example of
it. And a lot of the interspiritual dialogues that are happening that I know about. There's a guy, Kurt Johnson. You know Kurt Johnson?
No.
He was a student of Wayne Teasdale. You know, Brother Wayne Teasdale started interspiritual dialogues. So I think there is a coming together. I think you being a Jewish, you know, Buddhist Freemason, and writing some really key texts about Tibetan Buddhism is part of the transformation. And I think if we let go of all those separations, even the labels, Tibetan Buddha, and just talk about, because it's not, when you talk about the essential truths, it transcends Buddhism.
Oh, totally.
It is the essence of this. Of the science of incarnation.
What I try to explain in the Ecology of Oneness is really Buddhism is not a religion. It's a mind science.
But there's something even beyond. There's a basic fundamental of life in the body, and then the transformation of that consciousness. It's like, yes, I guess that's what you're talking about. But it's a science. It's not a belief.
No, it's not.
It's not a religion. It's something. It's a technology. If you use the Hoa, and this is what we have to come to collectively.
Well, I think a lot of what you're alluding to, Alan, is the idea of that really... what tends to happen, even in these sciences, a good example of this, this is a great example actually. A few days ago, I was having a conversation, and a friend of mine was talking about being in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And he was talking about, you know, they have all this belief about ghosts. Mm-hmm. They talk about ghosts all the time in Thai tradition, and that's so archaic and so antiquated.
It is until you meet a ghost.
So superstitious. And I said, now wait a second, okay. I said, so you're an Episcopalian,
mm-hmm.
okay, and you believe in angels.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. Mm-hmm. So here we have one culture that has non-visible beings,
mm-hmm.
that are dealing in their culture, and you have your own non-visible being in your culture. Okay, so once you begin to, and you can take it in the realm of spirituality, but then you can even start talking about it in terms of quantum physics,
mm-hmm.
and the idea of quote unquote psychic phenomena. Where does this stuff come? Mm-hmm. When you realize that. You know, every atom, most of what atoms are is space, okay? And they all have light. And the idea that, for example, a person could pick up an object from 50 years ago and feel impressions of that object from 50 years ago and be able to tell the story. Because what it is the molecules that are in that book or in that piece of wood, or in that stone, or in that piece of furniture, there are stories embedded in the molecular
emotion, feeling.
Exactly.
I've met experts who can do that. I don't doubt that.
Exactly. And so to me, I mean, a good example of this, there's a physicist by the name of Patrick Flanagan.
I know Patrick.
All right, Patrick.
He's a wild guy.
Patrick's a wild guy. And I remember he was talking about tensiometers in laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great example that a tensiometer measures the surface tension of water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? What's interesting about the surface tension of water, you put a tensiometer resting on a surface of water. What happens is if someone walks into the room, the surface tension of water will change.
Oh, really?
What that means is the water's already beginning to have a relationship with you the minute you walk into the room. I know another guy, I forget his name, I think his name is Michael, but I forget his full name. But he invented what was called the Genesis machine.
Mm.
The Genesis machine was a series of very sensitive biosensors
mm-hmm.
that you would put under a massage table. The person lies on the table in a titanium geodesic dome,
mm-hmm.
okay? And there are music speakers all around it, and they play music onto the person. And what happens is that if your body is dropping into an alpha or theta state, mm-hmm. what happens is the sensors go back to a computer and it re-equalizes the music to bring more alpha and theta into your experience.
As it adjusts to your state.
Exactly, exactly. Now, what's interesting about that, though, is this. You can, if no one is on the table and the biosensors are turned on, it also has a panel of musical instruments which will, if you lay on it, the musical instruments will play your body. Mm-hmm. But if no one's on the table, the sensors stretch out and try and find somebody to play.
Really? Wow.
Okay.
That's like intelligence.
Yes. So that is, and to me what it is that this is what's going on. To me, it's like when, you know, I have a friend who's a very, very left brain psychoanalyst. He's 100 years old. We just celebrated his birthday. He's a great mm-hmm. psychoanalyst. Fantastic. Thinks that, you know, I mean, psychic phenomena, all this stuff is a bunch of bunk. But now, as he understands that he's very close to dying, and he's made me responsible for his corporeal existence at this point. We have these conversations about things that he never would talk about because we're talking about the subtleties of psychic energies and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that this is, it's not that it's not science. It's just that it's kind of like the idea, I remember, that you know, you have it, for example, that you can talk to the conservative Republican community about sustainability. You cannot talk to them about global warming. It's language. Mm-hmm. The minute you put things, if you mm-hmm. say something is psychic, it's almost like the blinders go up or blinders go down. Yeah. We don't want to talk about this.
I know.
So the idea is that the science could translate. And this is what I would say in this, Alan, is this, is that this is where we start getting rid of territoriality. Mm-hmm. That the interaction between science, the science of the mind and the science of phenomena, is no different.
Right.
The quanta that goes back and forth between space and manifestation mm-hmm. is no different.
And also the beliefs of science, the religion of science. And, you know, I love, you knew Terence McKenna?
Yeah.
Terence McKenna said, yeah. Science is logical and all that, but they say, you give us one miracle, we'll explain all the rest. It all comes down to beliefs, and science itself is a belief system. In the beginning, there was light, there's a Big Bang, which is some kind of hypothetical, mythological event that is a distortion, in a sense.
Well, I mean, the idea is that the idea of first cause. Mm-hmm. is so important. And it's like, do you really need it? I mean, really, do you really need it? Is that going to make your day? Is it going to break your day? Mm. You know? But what's interesting about it is that logic that makes that illogical conclusion becomes the basis upon which all sorts of other things are put into place. And the question then becomes, at what point do you begin to accept that it's just one story? It's a good story, it's kind of an inclusive story, but it's just one story.
Right. It's one story among an infinite amount of stories. So to get people to understand the ecology of oneness, they have to be vigilant, they have to take responsibility for their actions and for their emotions, right? And for their for each other in a sense as well, because, you know, I can't just think about my $1 million like Trump. I have to think about how is that affecting, like Bernie Sanders tried to do, or like the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street. I mean, there have been political movements that have been for and against it, but, you know, practically, can it happen? Go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, no, can it happen? The answer is, yes, it can, and it takes both the collective and the personal work. The collective is creating the environments in which that personal work can take place.
Yeah.
You know, and so to me, I mean, it was really kind of funny. I remember with the Occupy movement, and I went down to Wall Street. I saw what was there, and then my wife Melanie went over to see the Occupy movement in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And I was involved with it when I was in San Luis Obispo. And what I was observing was that basically what fragmented it mm-hmm. more than anything was that, well, it's all about this and it's all about that. It's all about that. It's all about that. It's about that. It's about that. And what happened was that it's like, okay, listen, you know, you could be a little bit Republican about mm-hmm. this. Mm-hmm. What you can do is this. On Monday, let's talk about environmental issues. On Tuesday,
that makes sense.
Let's talk international issues. On Wednesday, let's talk about national issues. Mm-hmm. On Thursday, let's talk about state. On Friday, let's talk about local. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you have it so that there are these talking points that go out so that when the media comes, and so for example, a good example of this in San Luis Obispo where I lived was mm-hmm. that a guy thought that part of the conversation about the Occupy movement was the fact that he owned a cigar store mm-hmm. and that it was unfair that the city had a ban on cigar smoke. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that became suddenly somebody standing out there thinking that, and because nobody could distinguish.
So what do we do about that whole symptomology?
Okay. Well, the symptomology is a manifestation of ego, the manifestation right. of the three poisons mm-hmm. which Buddhism tries to transform: ignorance, attachment, and aggression. Ignorance is not understanding reality. Mm-hmm. Attachment is preferring my view of reality, mm-hmm. and aggression is me pushing away your view mm-hmm. and me defending mine.
And this is all ego. This comes down to ego. So if we were brought up in a culture that we realize we're not our story, then we'd have less ego attachment and a hope for this ecology of oneness, because we already are one. That is already me, there. I mean, that's this compassion, empathy.
I mean, I think what's interesting is this, and I think also what we need to do in that is we need to be honest about our stories, and we need to relate to people who are honest about their stories. There is a way in which when we have heroes on this planet, we have to airbrush their lives, okay?
Like even politicians we're voting
politicians,
for.
Politicians, exactly.
Instead of looking at the darkness, the truth, the kind of negative stuff they've done and
yeah,
acknowledging all of it, you're saying.
I think we have to do that for everybody. I think, I mean, a good example of that is I write about it in one of my books, The Passion of Buddha, is if you really look at the story of the Buddha, mm-hmm. if you want to put it in modern context, mm-hmm. you could say, well, the Buddha walked out on his wife. Mm-hmm. He walked out on his kids.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah. He was a deadbeat dad.
Yeah.
But he was lucky because his wife and his kid mm-hmm. were in a palace, so to some extent they were on welfare, mm-hmm. they were being taken care of, mm-hmm. so he could go do his spiritual thing. All right, mm-hmm. in the end what happens is he and his son and his wife reconcile, and they become all, and the his son becomes a teacher, his wife becomes a devotee and a meditator, mm-hmm. but the story in that is That what we have to realize is that even in the Buddha's enlightenment, what happened was he tried all of the asceticism and everything like that, and he realized he hadn't changed one iota of his mind.
Even in enlightenment.
No, he hadn't. He hadn't yet. He was trying all these things, mm-hmm. and nothing seemed to be working. Oh. He was just as miserable as he was in the beginning.
I see.
And then what happened was this young woman sat down next to him and said, "You look kind of hungry. Would you like a bowl of rice?" Mm-hmm. And what it said is that the woman's kindness. So this is the idea of the male and female. Mm. That it is a woman who saved the Buddha from his own mm. aestheticism. Mm.
So what happened? She said, would you like a bowl of rice?
Would you like something to eat? And he ate it. He felt better. And he was able to sit down and finish his journey. Mm. But he couldn't make that final journey until there was some kind of cooperation.
And from the universe.
And this is the ecology of oneness. What I mean, the idea of rugged individualism of us Americans is totally bogus. It takes a village, as Hillary Clinton wanted mm-hmm. to say. It takes a lot of people to make it possible. Here we are. I mean, what a beautiful space to be in. Thank you, Barbara Slain. Thank you, the builders who built this space. Thank you, the people who decided to create the legislation that made it not possible to cut down all these mm-hmm. trees in this area. There are all these steps and stages that we need to have gratitude for. Yeah. And to some extent, I would say that's where I'm also, in terms of my therapeutic background, I'm a what's called a lifeline practitioner, a student of, and a practitioner of a methodology by a man by the name of Darren Weissman, good friend and a great teacher. And he talks about the principles of infinite love and gratitude. And to me, it is always getting to that place where, how grateful are you in terms of what you have?
Mm. So in your life, as we wrap up here, I mean, you've done so much practice, you've done so much study and also work with the public. How are you still hungry? Are you still looking? Have you reached a place of peace? Have you, where's your individual sense in the ecology of oneness?
I would say I've gotten to a place in myself where there is a certain awareness of light that is unwavering. Mm. And in that unwavering, I still have to play out my stories.
You still have to. Well, have to, though.
I still have to play out my stories. I mean, what happens is, but because there's more space around my stories, space and light, I'm able to drop them more quickly, possibly.
Can you let them go completely?
Times, but at the same time, it doesn't mean that there's another. I mean, that's what's beautiful about the world. It's like, you know, when people say, "Oh, it's really over. I'm done with that one." And it's like, you know, or this is my last time. It's like, maybe. Okay, maybe.
Yeah, right.
All right. So to me, it's like, and then considering that to be a gift, because the gift is that a problem is really a portal of opportunity. Can I see that it's a portal of opportunity? Mm-hmm. So for me, where I'm at with is there's a part of me that feels sort of like, in terms of being aware of that, where I think it's kind of done in a way. And then there's all this aspect of my life where I work out things in my relationships with my wife, Melanie, with my kids, with the people in my community. And I just keep on dancing with it. And I what I would say is that because of my awareness of that light, and because I now realize the importance of gratitude and the importance of surplus given generates more surplus, I never feel empty, you know?
Except for the empty mind.
Do I feel tired? Yeah, except for the empty mind. And at times, do I feel tired?
Yes.
Yeah, I feel tired at times.
But there's a place of you that knows this is not all there is. I mean, is that for sure? Is a place like this 3D physical world? Of course, we're in it, and it's beautiful, and we love it, but you know that, do you know there's something more?
Or what you could say is, this is all there is, and we don't see what is.
That's true.
That's the story of in the Vimalakirti Sutra of the Buddha. It's like when the Buddha attained enlightenment. What they say is, it's kind of like when somebody attains enlightenment, it's like a cosmic blue light special.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So what happens is lights go off, and it's kind of like when your cat feels like you're having a good day and wants to sit on your lap. Okay. But suddenly all the gods and goddesses and everybody goes, what's going on? Mm-hmm. So what they say is that everybody came to see the Buddha.
Yeah.
And what happened was they saw the Buddha and they looked around. They saw people that were in one area, they were dying, and other people, they were sick. And there was all this warfare and all this stuff going on. And they go, this place is terrible. How can you say that this is an enlightened realm? And he said, this is how the world looks to the confused mind. And then he did what was called the earth witness gesture, where he touched his hand down to the ground. And he, they said, what they say in the teaching is that the world became totally golden and light. And he said, and this is how it actually is. Until we do the work we need to do, and he took his hands off the ground. He said, this is how it's going to look. So to me, here we are.
No, it is reminding me of what Jesus said in the Gospel of Thomas. When you're really here, everything else is known. When you're totally present, those spaces, that golden world, everything is here. Everything is here.
Vibrates with joy and held together by love. That's a phrase of a friend of mine, that everything vibrates with joy and is held together by love.
Okay.
That's the one I love.
Well, let's keep it going. Thank you, Robert, for your time and your studies and your and your service.
This was wonderful. This was sitting on a couch having a conversation.
Yeah, and understanding your life as a scholar, but more as a compassionate being that is making a difference in the world. You know, it's not just
What you're doing by just bringing cameras and just sitting down and the willingness to do this for folks.
Well,
so thank
I'm
you.
Doing it for me first, and if people benefit, I'm happy. But I'm doing it because I'm interested in the stories and the understanding of these histories, these lineages, these and also regular everyday people that have devoted their lives to something beyond themselves. That's what I really appreciate about you. That's
Thank you. Thanks again.
Okay, I'll say, this is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. I've been talking to Robert Sachs, and a website for you is...
It's two different websites. Well, actually, three websites. One is diamondwayayurveda.com, and that has to do with the healing work we do with respect to Ayurveda. So diamondwayayurveda.com. And then the book, it's called Ecology of Oneness, .com.
There you go. Okay, thank you. The Ecology of Oneness, this latest book by Robert Sachs. Thank you for watching. And